Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline, joined today by Dr. Karen Eigen and Dr. George Diaz. And we're going to talk about confronting ammonia in the ED, from sepsis to liver disease to other rare manifestations. This is one that is probably not on the first list of topics that you're looking for when you head to Scientific Assembly, but one that we deal with a fair amount within the emergency department. And we're going to talk with them and ask the questions about elevated ammonia, how it plays a role in the emergency department, and then what we can do about it, the risks of high ammonia, and then when to be concerned about it. So I appreciate both of you joining us here on the front line. And, you know, first and foremost, just kind of give us a background, an idea of how we as a team became focused on elevated ammonia in the emergency department.
Sure, absolutely.
So I am a pediatric emergency room physician. I've been practicing for about 23 years and married to a geneticist. So I do a metabolic program in the ER where I work. So we do see patients with metabolic disease occasionally, and thinking a lot about when we need to work a patient up for a new presentation about it. So, and, you know, happen to be married to a geneticist. So it's something that's probably a little bit more on my mind than other people's. So with that, I'll let George go.
Yeah. So, I'm a geneticist at Mount Sinai in New York. I've been there for 25 years, and we have one of the largest metabolic disease programs around. So this is kind of my bread and butter. I'm a site PI for the Rare Disease Clinical Research Network, urea cycle disorders clinical programs. And so really, these types of patients are my strong research interest. And so I manage a lot of patients with this condition, and you know, have consulted with a lot of folks kind of in the region and around the country.
Let's just walk through some of the basics. Let's start from the beginning here, and let's just go with some of the things that are going to tip us off in the emergency department to start looking for ammonia as the culprit, an elevated ammonia level, hyperammonemia. And I knew that this was going to be one of the words. Like, my mom has trouble saying cellular. Hyperammonemia is one that just, it's going to trip me up for some reason the entire time. I'm just going to say that it's maybe my, from being here in central Kentucky, that something in the water makes it difficult to put those letters together. But let's talk about some of those common symptoms and presentations that may warrant a consideration and further investigation of elevated ammonia levels.
Yeah, so I'll kind of start off with the metabolic genetics perspective. Hyperammonemia is really nonspecific. You know, it's problematic because it can present really at any age. You know, these diseases can present commonly in infancy. And so this is, you know, where you learn about it in medical school, you know, kind of the hyperammonemic crisis and with OTC deficiency and so on. But patients can get unmasked if they have an underlying predisposition to a hyperammonemic condition at any point in life. And the symptoms are generally vague initially. So even in infancy, it's pretty vague. So you've got some change in mental status. You know, patients might get a little bit hyperexcitable, you know, if they're older. You know, they might actually start to act differently, a little aggressively. And then you get a little bit of depression of the sensorium, and they'll start to really kind of cruise on into coma. Before that happens, usually they'll get nauseous and they'll start vomiting. So the high levels of ammonia are going to trigger this gut response. They'll be vomiting. So that's frequent, but that doesn't sound, you know, really specific. That could be any patient. So a vomiter in the ER is just nothing that you're going to be too concerned about. And that's part of the concern. The real risk for these patients is they come in, they look like every other patient, and you're going to miss the opportunity to intervene, because as the ammonia gets progressively higher, you get increasing neurological damage, and eventually becomes irreversible.
And while we're at it, let's, you know, you mentioned some of those consequences of missing this, and, you know, it's not something that's going to be on that primary radar. So Dr. Eigen, if it's suspected, what are the things that we're going to do to further investigate and confirm this as our diagnosis? And is there anything special than an ammonia level within the emergency department?
So the only way to pick it up is to get an ammonia level. So the first thing you have to do is think to get an ammonia level, which we frequently do not. And as George just said, a lot of the patients present with very common complaints, right? Vomiting, lethargy. These are things that we see all the time in the ER. So you really have to have a little bit of a suspicion before you even order the test. And then once you order the test, you have the added challenges of getting the specimen done properly to the lab, you know, quickly, processed quickly, because it's, you know, very commonly you get erroneously high levels if the test is not done correctly. So it's not an easy thing to do. It has to be a free flowing sample, right? I'm sure you know. And that's, you know, not an easy thing to accomplish, especially in a dehydrated patient or a young patient or even an elderly patient. So it's, you know, again, first step is thinking of it, ordering it, and then getting the test.
So with that in mind, Dr. Diaz, in your experience, you know, this isn't clearly part of the standard panel that's going to come in, especially, you know, altered mental status, confusion, whatever it may be. When somebody comes in the emergency department, a lot of times it does have to have a high index of suspicion. And so it probably is ordered on a significant minority of cases. And then, and even then, potentially, once we don't have another answer for the syndrome or the symptoms that are presenting. What are some of the things or protocols you can put in place or team members or resources that you may want to have available when you start putting elevated ammonia levels on the differential?
Yes, that's a great question. I think really the thing that should maybe trigger a consideration for ammonia testing is the clinical history. I mean, I don't think that anybody that comes in first time vomiter, no really significant medical history, antecedent symptoms, is going to merit having ammonia done. It's just way too common. Your yield is too low. But if you've got somebody that has a recurrent history of unexplained vomiting, you know, somebody that after you know, every holiday, you know, Thanksgiving, big protein load, is vomiting. Somebody who has a history of avoiding, you know, high protein foods. Like we've got patients who will tell you, yeah, I had a hamburger, but all they eat is the bun. You know, they never eat the meat, you know, that kind of thing. So it all comes back to index of suspicion. You ask a couple of questions, and if it's suggestive, then maybe you'll think, okay, this is somebody who, you know, is got some aversive behaviors with food, has had this happen a few times, you know, and kind of has improved, and nobody really knows why. Maybe then you can consider. The other thing to consider is liver function tests. A lot of the patients with underlying urea cycle disorders will have some elevation of transaminases during decompensation events. And so that can be a clue. We've had a number of referrals from gastroenterologists who've had kids being worked up or adults being worked up for liver disease. And, you know, then they send them to us for metabolic evaluations because they're not finding anything. And it turns out these patients have a urea cycle disorder.
Let's actually talk about that a little bit, because I think when all of us think about elevated ammonia levels, we're thinking about the classic, you know, liver-related disease, hepatic encephalopathy, and the chronic alcohol patient. But, you know, both of you have mentioned a lot of focus on pediatric, younger, or otherwise healthy populations. What's the differential diagnosis? Let's just say we went about it backwards, and we got it. Somebody got an ammonia level. It's elevated. It's just sitting there. What's a good, decent differential diagnosis that emergency physicians need to throw in there if it's not a classic population of liver disease where it's obvious what the primary source is going to be?
Right. So first thing is making sure that the test is done right. Right. So that's my number one source of referrals is hyperammonemia with a sample where you've got a tourniquet on, sample wasn't free flowing, sample wasn't put on ice, wasn't processed immediately. You're going to get an artificially elevated level. So, you know, just making sure that this collection was done appropriately. And if it's a true hyperammonemia, then you kind of want to consider a couple of things. If you're in a pediatric age group, one of the things that you want to look at is growth and development. Is this a child that's got developmental issues, a child that's got growth issues from aversive behaviors, you know, eating potentially? You know, if you see other things, then you can, I think, start to put together a differential of underlying metabolic disease that might explain this elevated ammonia level. And that doesn't have to be just a urea cycle defect, right? So that can be an underlying organic acidemia where you've got a secondary hyperammonemia. So any one of these metabolic diseases that interfere with the appropriate functioning of the liver to metabolize ammonia can give you this secondary hyperammonemia. You also have anatomic defects to consider, right? So hyperammonemia from portal shunting. If you're talking about an older age population, think about medication. So valproic acid is kind of a classic that can cause elevation of ammonia kind of affecting the ability of the liver to process appropriately. And if you're looking at somebody who's had surgery, think about bacterial overgrowth. So I've had definitely some cases where people have come in for hyperammonemia, did a full evaluation for a primary urea cycle defect, and there was none. But really, they'd had a surgical history, treated with antibiotics, kind of got rid of the bacterial overgrowth. And so the urease-positive bacteria that were cleaving urea and producing ammonia is kind of the root cause there. So, I think that is the, again, looking at the history, looking at the patient and the context, it gives you an idea of what might be causing hyperammonemia.
And, Dr. Eigen, Dr. Diaz was mentioning some of the challenges with the testing and getting the tests. And that's actually something, I teach my students quite often is if you get a test that is significantly abnormal that you're not expecting, the first and foremost thing is to recheck the test or confirm the test, especially when you're dealing with electrolytes, but ammonia sounds like it's similar. And when you, for us in the emergency department, we're talking about accurately obtaining ammonia levels, whether it's in the adult or pediatric populations, is what are the things that we need to consider in educational standpoints that we need to do to make sure that we're getting accurate testing when we're in the emergency department and then some of the challenges that may come up with that?
So the very first thing you need to do is to make sure you have the correct tubes, right? So it's a green top tube that goes on ice. So everybody needs to be aware of that. And if it's a pediatric population, you want the smaller tubes so that you can get an adequate sample. So you need to have the tubes. You need to have a plan in place of how you're going to get that tube to the lab because time is of the essence. And then you need to know that your lab knows how to process it. So if you sent the test and it's an hour and a half has gone by and you don't have a result, that increases the likelihood that you're going to get a false positive. Because if the blood is sitting around, it may not be an accurate level. So it's really about having a plan in place, which is a lot easier in a center where you see metabolic patients regularly, because then you're doing the test sort of periodically. And so you can sort of test your planning. But if you don't do it regularly, probably the first time you send it, you're going to get an erroneously high level. And it's something that you have to always consider, especially if the other labs are normal, which frequently they are. I mean, sometimes you get the little clue of the elevated LFTs, but many times, you have a kid who maybe has a little bit of a low blood sugar. So that explains the lethargy. And the LFTs and everything else is normal. So it's really important to sort of do a dry run of the process with your ER and with your lab and what your phlebotomy team is capable of or your nurses are capable of. And sometimes it does take a doctor going in there and doing an arterial blood draw to get a reliable sample.
With that in mind, though, it sounds like you guys mentioned the free-flowing sample, tourniquets off, that sort of thing. Is there any batch or grouping of labs along with it other than the time? Because I think when you start saying, if you don't have it back in an hour and a half, it's kind of like the old saying, if I'm not back in an hour and a half, just wait longer kind of approach. And then if you call them, of course, it'll be ready in 5 minutes. Is most of our labs are going to have some sort of delays, processing times, phlebotomy times that it, for the sample to actually get obtained, sent up there, run, all that stuff. Most of us, very few of us live in a ideal situation where those things turn quickly. Are there things that we look for if we get an elevated ammonia level that may tip off that it is a compromised sample, or is it just Or is it just that if it seems out of place or potentially rechecking it, that we need to just question it if it doesn't fit the presenting symptoms?
Yeah. So one of the clues is our lab will reject samples for hemolysis. And so, you know, if you've got an obviously hemolyzed sample, you know, it's a colorimetric test. You know, labs may not run it. Or if they run it, you may get a falsely elevated result because, you know, the readout's not good. So, you know, that's definitely something that you want to, you can actually maybe spot check that. But the lab will let you know if the sample is inadequate from hemolysis. You know, the rest of it, like with time, you know, you're kind of getting metabolism going on in the cells in the sample over time. And so, you know, there's nothing you can do at the point of collection, you know, unless you know that there's a tourniquet on. So that's going to artificially elevate the ammonia. But if you're free flowing and you know it's on ice and the sample went in good shape, but it's not getting processed in the lab, you know, there's really no way to know. And that's just you watching the clock.
To be honest with you, sometimes I just give it a shot with the labs that are initially drawn. And if it's normal, you don't have to worry about it, right? So even if the blood was taken with a tourniquet on, if you have a normal ammonia that's run in a reasonable amount of time, then you can take that off of your differential. So if it's elevated and I don't feel like sure that it was a great blood draw, then I'll repeat it.
Yeah. When you see with the blood samples, like a lot of times now we're using these, using the ultrasound guide to getting more middle veins as opposed to the really superficial veins with the challenging sticks. Does that tend to behave better because the less tourniquet impact, or does it really not matter and we just need to try our best to make sure we just get the free flowing sample no matter that source minus a deep line, which we all know that source there.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any data kind of looking at that. That's actually a really interesting question. You know, whether there's going to be a variation, you know, kind of depending on how deep a vessel lies. So I think for now, absent any data, I would suggest, you know, just, you know, doing a good free flowing sample and considering.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great thought because we are doing a lot more ultrasound guided procedures. But once you are talking about that, then you have a physician in the room already, and then you may as well just get the arterial sample, you know? So, but if in that case, I think you probably could get a more reliable sample. It's something to think about for the future.
Gives you an opportunity for some great research coming up. Congratulations. I just gave you work to do.
I'm going to name my R01 grant after you. It's going to be great.
Oh, that'll be awesome. That'll be something that I never would have ever seen coming was one, me being involved with or any research named after me, and two, it having to do anything with ammonia. But that would be awesome. And it would be cool to find out stuff because I do love some ultrasound guided IVs. But now we've got the information. We've got a great sample. Everybody's done everything correctly. The lab is behaving. Everything comes back in a timely fashion. We've got accurate numbers and we have an elevated ammonia level. Now we're not going to delve into the treatment aspect of this because we really want to just look at the ammonia itself. And then, you know, what are the resources in terms of folks to help manage? And because once we have it, now we have to do something about it. Like the whole idea in the emergency department, don't go looking for something unless you can deal with it or have a plan for it once you find it. So what are the role of specialists and with the diagnosing and management and bringing those in and getting involvement within the emergency department?
Good. So what I do is I call George. But what should
that's other- exactly what I'm going to do as well.
What should other ERs do?
Yeah. So I mean, I think if you're in an academic medical center, you know, generally this is a no-brainer because you've got your consultants plugged in. You know, if you don't have genetics, usually there's endocrinologists or somebody kind of plugged in for metabolic disease. I think that you know, the care team for any hyperammonemic patient that's primary hyperammonemia should always involve a geneticist at some level if it's kind of a distant consultant or patient managing directly. We always involve nephrology because, you know, the need for dialysis in extreme hyperammonemia. So you kind of got to look at the level and see if you've got a patient that's obtunded and the ammonia is in the hundreds, you know, the need for dialysis is probably going to be jumping edge pretty quickly. So you want to engage nephrology really early in the game and kind of get them ready for that possibility, because you know the rest of the management really is about preserving the brain, and you know so the brain is kind of getting it's swelling over time. You're going to get cerebral edema as a consequence of high and sustained ammonia levels. So you know that's kind of where you need to aim your team.
When you're sitting in our community house, most of the folks listening are going to be community-based physicians. And, you know, it's like today, I had a patient ask me to call and have so that their endocrinologist could come see them in the emergency department, of course, during a pandemic. And I laughed so hard that I almost passed out, because I don't know that if we gave them a map and sent them a Google pin, they'd necessarily be able to find the emergency department. Because most community facilities and community physicians, endocrinologists aren't necessarily going to frequent the emergency department. You can refer. We have great referral. They're happy to see our folks, but really don't do any of that urgent-based stuff. So most of our physicians out there are going to be in a community-based system where they're not going to have the geneticist. They're not going to have the endocrinologist at ready standby. Of course, the majority of ER time is after hours or off hours. And so not necessarily any clinics open that you can call and run it by folks. What if I get this number, if I get this elevated number, and it's not an easy explanation in terms of what's going on, or if I'm looking at it in a pediatric population, looking at some of the congenital or developmental issues, when we call that tertiary referral or academic center, what are we asking for and what are we looking for?
Right. So if you're managing somebody who is got a high ammonia level, is obtunded, and is going to need some tertiary care, you're going to want somebody that can transport that patient to a high level of care rapidly. And, you know, again, with hyperammonemia, you don't necessarily need a metabolic geneticist, you know, as the first step. You need somebody that can drop that ammonia quickly. And so that typically means getting them to a center where they can do dialysis, stabilize the patient, and kind of move them along to a specialist for longer term management. The other thing that really is important here is for patients that have an underlying metabolic disease, catabolism is really kind of their enemy. And a lot of these patients usually will have had some kind of viral syndrome. You know, they've had vomiting, gastro, something kind of tips them over. So it's really important to try to reverse that process. And usually that means giving them some dextrose, giving them some sort of energy while they're unable to, you know, kind of take anything in orally to kind of replete their energy. So that's something that you can do in the ED. You know, if you've got a patient that has a high ammonia level, just fluids, you know, kind of basic electrolytes isn't going to really get at the root problem, which is sometimes just, you know, they need energy. So you give them some dextrose, give them D5, D10, whatever you got, that can kind of help stabilize them. And then you can move them along.
I'd like to get both of y'all, both of your thoughts on, you know, this aspect of things. And because I think we all know, anybody been in emergency medicine for a while knows that ammonia level is not by a number. It's not a, you know, a linear scale of this number equals this badness. You know, depending on where somebody sits on baseline, a high number for one is going to be basically nothing for the other. Whereas that high number, that's nothing for one can be, you know, it's going to be life-threatening, debilitating for the other. What are the things that the emergency and acute care physicians and other healthcare providers need to look at to say this number is not only a significant number, but a time-sensitive number that they have a high likelihood of near-term deterioration for both the adult and pediatric population?
Do you have a number, an exact number?
Yeah, so that's very...
Yeah, it's not going to be a number. I know it's not going to be a number, but you've got a number now, what signs or symptoms or presentations do I look for to say, oh, crap, this is now a really time-sensitive situation?
Yeah, it really is mental status. I've been kind of talking about the brain the whole time. And, you know, kind of as the brain is sitting there you know, getting hit with this higher increasing level of ammonia, it's starting to swell. And so if you've got somebody who initially presented with some vomiting and some, you know, altered mental status, a little bit of belligerence, whatever, and now that patient is starting to become, you know, obtunded, and then becoming unresponsive, you're very, very time sensitive at that point. You know, you've got to act very rapidly because you're at risk of herniating. And so that's really an important piece. I've definitely been engaged in cases where patients were sedated and, you know, kind of because they were vomiting and really agitated, they had their airway protected. So they were intubated. Now nobody knows what their mental status is. And they were kind of just sitting there waiting for a consultant. And all this time their brain is swelling and then they ultimately herniate. So, you know, I think that that's the number one thing. You got to look at mental status. And once they're, kind of looking comatose, you got to move fast. And so this is the whole point of intervening early.
So, and like what George is saying is the kids who present or the adults even who present later in life, they can have mild symptoms and maybe not terribly elevated pneumonias and you maybe can fix them in the ER, right? Like, so we had this kid who was coming to our ER maybe every like 2 or 3 months with vomiting, was always a little lethargic at presentation, got some IV fluid, some D5, and then looked better and was sent home 3 or 4 times. And she had an underlying urea cycle disease that was missed. And then she presented to another ER in status epilepticus and did not survive. So sometimes it's, you know, you could fix them in the ER, but if you miss the diagnosis, they're ultimately going to have, you know, a devastating event. So it's, I think more likely that you're just going to miss it and not so much that you're going to have them with such a high ammonia presentation that you need to act.
Right. The milder cases for sure. And so I think that, you know, again, that's the point of history. If you're seeing these kind of recurrent events, that should make you think, you know, could something else be going on here?
I think that's a big consideration because adults, a lot of times will think about elevated ammonia levels, but pediatrics is a little bit more of a nebulous. And especially if you've got, like my facility, we don't admit pediatrics, but we actually have OB services and NICU and all that other stuff. But once the kid makes it out of the hospital, then they are on their own. I mean, they aren't admitted back to our facility. And so there's not a ton of pediatric activity, a lot of sick pediatric activity, but we do see some genetic congenital related stuff bouncing back in, as well as, you know, that potential, my kid was born here, so we want to bring him here. And I think a lot of people may deal with that. And the biggest challenges, and this is a good conversation with the ammonia levels and, you know, some of these other disease processes, because in the community setting, it may be something that's kind of an out of sight, out of mind that we may not see enough to really have it on the radar consistently, but it may be something that, especially in the pediatric population, may be able to make a significant impact if addressed rather early. Let's see if you guys have any other thoughts. I mean, closing thoughts on advice and things, take home messages, the Cliff Notes version for the emergency physician and healthcare provider out there for elevated ammonia levels and some of these disease processes.
Yeah. So I think from my perspective, you know, it really is all about identifying these cases. We know that there are cases out in the community that are missed because they're presenting late in life. And, you know, every now and then, like once a year or so, you'll get a newspaper story or some tragedy of, you know, somebody who had a surgery and had steroids and then, you know, kind of was unmasked and had a hyperammonemia crisis and died, or, you know, a woman after childbirth. So these metabolic stressors, I think that's an important point. Like, if you look at the recent history, if there's some stressor, that might unmask hyperammonemia. I was involved in this really interesting case of an individual who had a motor vehicle accident and actually did, you know, relatively well after that, but was given a high protein drink, you know, for rehab, you know, to kind of promote wound healing. And that's what unmasked his underlying metabolic disease, you know, became hyperammonemic and, you know, recovered, did well. But, you know, it's really what's happening around that hyperammonemic event that can be an important clue. So, you know, kind of keep an open mind around that for these patients.
And the other thing that we've tried to do at our institution is to get ammonia into the order sets. So if you pull open an order set for altered mental status, vomiting, I mean, it's not automatically ordered, but it's there as an option. So it just kind of reminds you a little bit like, do I want to send an ammonia on this patient? Maybe, or, you know, maybe not, but at least it puts the thought in your head.
Yeah.
How can folks get more information, or where should they go now that we've got them everybody a little bit tweaked up and the fact that everybody's thinking, oh crap, I don't want to miss this, especially in a kid.
Yeah, so, you know, there's actually a great website called checkammonia.com, which was put together by the National Urea Cycle Disease Foundation, parent organization that supports patients and families with urea cycle disorders and Recordati rare disease. And so there are a lot of resources on that webpage, including, you know, signs and symptoms of hyperammonemia, how to draw tests, and, you know, where are metabolic geneticists in your state. So, you know, that's a kind of a page that has a lot of resources. And I think that, you know, that can be very helpful for folks.
And any other contact information that our listeners need to know about, or suggested readings or whatnot, or even if they have questions for you guys following the podcast?
So the Urea Cycle Disorders Consortium actually has got information for providers and for families. So if you Google Urea Cycle Disease Consortium, UCDC, there's a whole webpage with a lot of resources. And, you know, there are a lot of specialty centers that are carrying out research. It's actually an international consortium. So I think that can be very helpful. The internet's a beautiful thing. You know, there's a lot of information out there, but this is really good quality embedded information.
There's a lot of fantastic information. You just got to know the context and where to find it and how to apply it once you get there. Talking with Dr. Karen Eigen and Dr. George Diaz, and hope everybody's gotten their fill of ammonia for the day and something to keep on your radar to keep a lookout, especially with those cases as they come into your emergency department, and for that differential, and also understanding how to avoid some of the pitfalls with the samples and results that may be in error. As for me, you can contact me, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, or @everydaymed on Twitter. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline.